He started to drive through this tight canyon area, and there was fire all around. And we started to go through, and he had to stop and back up, because literally we were driving through fire.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. From ranches to rigs, this podcast tells stories of the West as it is. This month, we reach into the archives to hear stories about the big 1988 Yellowstone fire and what fire conditions there may be like in the future. We'll start with author Jeff Henry. Back in 1988, 36% of Yellowstone National Park was engulfed in flames, and to this day, it remains the largest wildfire since Yellowstone became a national park. At the time, Jeff Henry was a young park employee, a budding photographer, and he was asked to take photos of the fire. Earlier this year, Henry published a book about the fires that includes numerous photographs he took on the front lines. The book is called The Year Yellowstone Burned, a 25-year perspective. Henry told Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck how politicians and others were critical of the park's handling of the fires.
I think there was a perception that the Park Service allowed the fires to grow out of control, when the reality is, in my opinion, that was not the case. I personally think the fires were just a force of nature that was beyond control. It was, in my mind, I could compare the fires of 1988 to a hurricane in Texas or Louisiana or a tornado in Oklahoma.
It was a very dry year, and there was an overgrowth of the forest. Is that correct?
It was a very dry, very windy year, very hot year. It was unusually warm in Yellowstone, and things dried out really quickly. The previous winter wasn't that dry. The snowpack was less than average, but not grossly so. And the spring of that year was actually wet. So it was primarily weather conditions that commenced after about the 1st of June or so, and those weather conditions were strong wind, low humidities, and pretty much the complete absence of precipitation for the summer.
Were the firefighters in danger often?
In my opinion, they were. I think it's just incredible good fortune that no one was killed during the fire season that year. And that would be not just for firefighters who were on the lines, but a great many civilians and park employees were in jeopardy at different times. And I think it was just a matter of really a lot of good luck that nobody was killed. There were two unfortunate firefighters killed outside the park during the mop-up period in the fall. One fellow was killed when a burn snag fell on him, and there was an airplane or a helicopter crash south of Yellowstone that killed the pilot.
Jeff Henry visiting with us today. He is the author of The Year Yellowstone Burned. It's a 25-year perspective. Did you sense that it was such as big a deal as it turned out to be?
I did. I had a sense early on in the season that year that it was going to be a big fire season. I remember even proposing some stories to various publications. I was working on the side as a freelance photographer in those days, in addition to my Park Service jobs. So early on, I had a sense that it was going to be a big fire season. And then once the fires began, again, I'd have to say, and I'm not trying to brag or pat myself on the back, but I think early on I realized that it was going to be historic. We had really pretty radical fire behavior early in the season that year, with still 2 or 2.5 months of the fire season left to go. That meant that there were another 2 months or so of time for the conditions to dry out, for the conditions of the forest to dry out even further, and they did. So I think that early on I realized it was going to be a special story.
I assume firefighters are busy performing the task at hand, but how many of them were aware of maybe some of the media coverage that was going on out there? And I was kind of curious your assessment of what they thought of it.
My recollection is that a lot of the mainstream media missed the Yellowstone fire story until the season was somewhat advanced. Then they seemed to play catch-up ball to make up for what they missed earlier by really focusing on the fires during the second half of the season or so, or the last third of the season. And I do remember a great many of the firefighters were irritated with media people. They were seen as intrusive and also often putting themselves in jeopardy.
There was a perception that Yellowstone had burned up and that it would never recover. Now that you look back, and especially for those of us who have the opportunity to go to Yellowstone, it's kind of worked out, hasn't it? Like a lot of folks said it would, that were in the know, that things would regrow and it would look fine.
It has. I've been lucky enough to be in Yellowstone for a long time. I first showed up to work in Yellowstone 38 years ago yesterday. Yesterday was my anniversary day. And so I've been lucky enough to see the regeneration from the 1988 fires. And yes, you're right. Most of the country that burned has regenerated nicely. Just about all the areas that were forested before 1988 have regenerated as forest. The flat areas have come back better than the slopes, but pretty much everything is on its way back, in some cases very much on its way back, well on its way back. Some of the new trees are probably 20 to 25 feet tall. Yes, there was a perception that Yellowstone was destroyed in 1988. And again, I think the media might have overstated their case that Yellowstone was a burned-out wasteland by the end of the fire season in 1988. I saw it as an opportunity to see nature at work. You know, there were places where I saw vegetation regenerating just within a matter of a week or two of when the site had burned. I saw grass and other graminoids sprouting from burned areas just a week or so after the flames had passed, and the plants were sprouting without the benefit of much moisture. Everybody knows that the summer of 1988 was really dry. So even without some rainfall, and even though the areas had burned just a short while before, some of the grasses were coming up almost immediately. And then the next spring, there were just literally hundreds of thousands of tree seedlings per acre in some cases, and certainly a profusion of wildflowers and grasses. It was beautiful to see, and it's been really interesting to watch for these, what is it now, 27 years, I guess.
Is it a good idea to try and let them burn as long as they can without people obviously being put at risk?
Well, to me, it's a complex issue. Certainly in the past, historically, fire was an agent that removed old vegetation and cleared the way for new. And generally, I think that, yeah, fire has its place in a natural ecosystem. I will say that I'm a firm believer in climate change. And I think that the climate has warmed and is going to warm a lot more because of human activity. And in that regard, I don't see fire as such a natural element anymore.
That's Jeff Henry. He's the author of The Year Yellowstone Burned, A 25-Year Perspective. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck. And later in the show, we'll hear about how a changing climate could bring more fires to the park. Next, we'll hear from Joan Anselmo. At the time of the 88 fire, she was the spokesperson for Yellowstone National Park, and she remembers what it was like to be at the center of the firestorm.
In June, no one in Yellowstone was overly concerned about the small fires that had ignited, because every year there are lightning-caused fires. But as the month wore on, it began to be clear that this was not going to be a normal summer in Yellowstone. I remember on August 20th, we were going to head south and observe what was happening at some of the fire camps. And that morning, my house had been foamed when I was leaving to go for this tour. And so I was leaving and watching my house be foamed and not really sure what I was coming back to. And we were all seated in the car. I was in the back seat and Mr. Barbie was driving. And he started to drive through this tight canyon area, and there was fire all around. And we started to go through, and he had to stop and back up, because literally we were driving through fire. And I'm looking at this and thinking, this is not good. And we had to decide if we were going forward or not. And again, Bob Barbie's the driver, so I'm a passenger. And so I just put my confidence in him, and he watched for that opening, and then he gunned the engine and he drove us through Golden Gate. And, you know, we got to live to tell the story. We went on, we got through that little firewall. And as we approached Old Faithful, we went and parked the car near the Old Faithful Inn on a slight rise. We stood there and we looked out, and in all directions, there were four convection columns, each probably 50 to 60,000 feet in the atmosphere. For me, it was very clear how small we are as human beings on the planet. And I knew that there was absolutely nothing that man was going to do to stop these fires. It was just one of those telling moments where the power of nature was so in our face, and it was so obvious that it didn't matter what we said, it didn't matter what we did, we just had to hope that the rain would come or the snow would come, because the only thing that was going to put the fires out was nature. The same forces that began them, it was going to take the powers of nature to put them out. And we continued on to West Thumb Junction that afternoon, and visitors were still at West Thumb. I have this kind of foggy memory of going up to these folks and saying, it would be really great for you to get out of this area. It was clear that their fire was on the move. The winds were so, so high. When I think about just kind of the, at times, a chaos and pandemonium, quite honestly, in a time that those fires were unprecedented, it is truly a miracle that no one died. If you look at, historical notes, August 20th became known as Black Saturday. The reason for that is that on that day, more than 150,000 acres burned in a single burning period, which is an exorbitant amount of acreage to burn in a single day. But it was probably one of the most remarkable days that I ever experienced in my life, was to witness what it was like to be in the center of Yellowstone on August 20th, 1988. We did have the world that summer come from the world of news media to cover the Yellowstone fires. As it became clear that this was an unprecedented event, and only a handful of reporters at the time had the knowledge and the understanding of fire management, Yellowstone's ecology, to really be able to tell the bigger and the deeper stories. But on the other hand, the National Park Service, who I worked for, also bears some responsibility. We just did not have the experience to be able to help corral and help all of those thousands of news organizations that assembled in Yellowstone and were spreading the word that Yellowstone was lost, that Yellowstone was completely burned up, that the animals were dying, that the hot springs were going away. And that wasn't true. But when you're in the heat of the battle and the pictures are so dramatic and convection columns of smoke are, 40 and 50 and 60,000 feet in the atmosphere, it's hard to tell the bigger story. When I look back at it, there are things that I would have loved to have known then, that I learned that year and that I have learned since, and maybe would have shaped some of the messaging differently. But at the end of the day, what Yellowstone did in 1988 pioneered the way for all of the other land management agencies with fire policy. Because if you go agency by agency today, many of the present day fire management policies reflect the importance of having some natural fire and the impossibility of stopping fire on that scale. And now the agencies will not risk the firefighters' lives to do that. So we learned so, so many lessons from 1988.
At the time of the fire, Joan Anselmo was the spokesperson for the park. She's since retired and lives in Jackson Hole. Rebecca Huntington produced the piece. Okay, we've been talking about what the 1988 Yellowstone fire really was like. Now, here's a fictional take on the event. Picture this. You're a park ranger living in a watchtower in the Wyoming wilderness. No cell phone, no internet, no coworker to keep you company. Your only human contact is with your boss on a handheld radio. But when unexpected events occur, you're faced with exploring a wild and unknown environment. And that's where a new video game set in Wyoming begins. Wyoming Public Radio's Anna Rader has the story.
This is the plot of Firewatch, the first video game to be released by a small game developer in San Francisco called Campo Santo. The game is the creation of two former Wyoming residents, designer and programmer Nels Anderson and designer and writer Sean Vanneman. Their past work includes big-name video games like The Walking Dead and Mark of the Ninja. Firewatch is set in the vast Shoshone National Forest in 1989, a year after the devastating Yellowstone fires. Nels Anderson was born and raised in Jackson and remembers the fires.
I was pretty young, but I still vaguely remember what that summer was like. Town was constantly smoky. That was a thing that always growing up in summer, it gets really smoky for a few days and people worry about their house getting burned down. That's normal, right? And actually, that's not an experience that most human beings have to live through.
Sean Vanneman moved to Cody when he was 9 and lived there until he went to college in 2002. He says living in Wyoming inspired Firewatch.
I like to be alone a lot, and Wyoming's a really good place for that. Because you can just go 5 minutes from your house, or sometimes right outside your front door, depending on where you live, and be like really by yourself. And that's the feeling that I think has been sort of internalized in a lot of my work, maybe. I mean, it's something I feel I always bring to it. I'm always pulling from it.
Firewatch is what's called a first-person exploratory adventure game with a focus on plot and dialogue. What sets Firewatch apart from many video games is that there are no aliens, zombies, or monsters. Vanneman says it strives to be about real people from a real place.
The game is basically about the relationship between two people set like in the Wyoming backcountry. The game is not about challenge or defeating enemies. It's about learning to be the person that you are and forcing to make dialogue decisions in conversation with somebody you're getting to know. But at the same time, you'll be uncovering a mystery.
The mystery unfolds as the protagonist maintains radio contact with his supervisor. Based on those conversations and decisions, the player dictates the direction of the game's plot. As with any good mystery set in the wilderness, the notion of isolation is fundamental to what Firewatch is about.
If you go out into the middle of nowhere with emotional baggage, how long is it until that stuff catches up with you? What does it take for that stuff to really start to like eat away at you in a way that's not healthy?
And Vanneman and Anderson want the game to feel as tangible as possible. From the books sitting in the Lookout's bookshelf to the foliage and geology, the game will transport players to smack dab in the middle of Wyoming.
We'll be using real city names. People are from real places in Wyoming at a real time and talk about how there's a rodeo every night in the summer in Cody, what it's like when there's traffic between Jackson and the Teton, road construction, I should say. Hopefully we make good on
the Wyomingness.
On all the Wyomingness. That way we can go back to our respective towns and not be
ashamed.
Firewatch is set to be released in mid-2015 and will be available on PC, Mac, and Linux. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Anna Rader.
So hang your rose and your tennis clothes. It's Campo Santo for me. Set sail for Campo Santo, boys.
1, 2, 3, 4.
This is the life for me.
Finally, we'll hear from Karina Reginos about a new study. The Coming Climate, Ecological Impacts of Climate Change on Teton County was commissioned by the Chartour Institute. Reginos is a research ecologist who co-authored the report, and she tells Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard the data itself isn't new, but Reginos and her co-author are using it to make predictions about what could happen to the ecosystem and the economy in northwestern Wyoming.
We drew widely on a variety of sources, published peer-reviewed scientific literature about effects of climate change in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and other regions like it.
What you seem to be arguing in this paper, one of the major points, is that forests of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem could essentially disappear in a rather short time frame. How could that happen?
So the predictions for the future climate of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem are that we would see an average warming of about 3 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And this amount of warming is enough to actually make a much drier summer conditions and much drier forests in the summer, which could lead to conditions ripe for forest fires. And the predictions that have been done showed that the fires of the size of the 1988 fires in Yellowstone, the conditions necessary to produce fires of that size could occur anywhere from 1 to 5 times before 2050. And by 2075, those conditions could actually occur every year, which would essentially mean that every part of the Yellowstone ecosystem would burn every 10 years. And if that happens, it wouldn't really be enough time for trees to grow up and set seed and, you know, let the next generation of trees establish after a fire. So effectively, trees would not be able to recolonize in the places that were burned, and it would probably not be able to be a forest anymore.
So what would Yellowstone look like if it weren't a forest anymore?
Right. It's really hard, obviously, to draw an exact mental picture. And I think that, you know, there are likely places that would be refuges from fire and that would still be forested. But there would also be places that would be burned frequently enough that the forest would disappear and probably be replaced. In a good scenario, they might be replaced by native shrubs like sagebrush or juniper. In a bad scenario, they might be replaced by invasive species like cheatgrass or other invasive species like musk thistle.
Maybe there's more shrubland or maybe there's fewer forests. What does that really mean for some of these species like grizzlies, like moose, things that are very iconic to this area of the country and to Wyoming.
White bark pine is highly threatened by climate change, not just because of the possibility of forest fire, but also because it's a tree species that really does well in cool climate. And the predictions show that even just looking at temperature increases, white bark pine would probably be restricted to pretty small area of the Yellowstone ecosystem. And white bark pine produces really fat, nutritious seeds that are at present a key food resource for grizzly bears, for Clark's nutcrackers, and a variety of other species. So without that food source, it's possible that those species could really suffer. On the other hand, ecological systems are complicated, and some of these species may be more able to adapt and change their behavior than we expect, and it's possible that they may find other food sources, and they might do just fine.
Speaking with Corinna Reginos, an author on the coming climate, ecological impacts of climate change on Teton County, one of the interesting things about this study was you kind of mapped out a little bit of some of the economic impacts that this might have. What are some of those?
One of the things that we found was there might be some positive economic impacts, basically because this region, it is a pretty cold climate, relatively speaking, so it might be very attractive to people to come visit. Imagine much hotter summers. People might flock to Yellowstone because it's actually relatively cool. But at the same time, there could be negative impacts. For example, these more frequent fires would make it unpleasant for people to visit. So there's a variety of summer impacts. And then, of course, in the winter, the impacts for the ski and snow-based tourism industries, reduced snow pack and reduced duration of snow cover could mean less opportunities for winter recreation and less winter tourism. Although I think on the short term, in the next couple of decades, we might actually see more visitors because we actually have relatively more snow than some of the other places that are experiencing a lot less snow in recent years, such as Colorado and California. In places like Teton County, where tourism is a big part of the economy, the connections between the health of the ecosystem and the health of our economy are tightly linked. And so understanding potential changes and potential threats to the future of our ecosystem is important for understanding what the future might look like.
That's research ecologist Corinna Reginos speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard about predicted impacts of climate change on Yellowstone National Park. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. Catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about The Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Caitlin Heyer produced this podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.